At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome to Going In Blind. I'm your host, Zach Tidwell, and my guest today is a social psychologist and author. Please welcome Jamie Hughes. And to everyone at home, thank you for listening. Please take a second to help me grow the show so that I can keep delivering these conversations week after week for years to come. Subscribe, rate, and review the show in whatever podcasting app you're using right now, and check out the show notes to follow me on social media and YouTube as well. When you share your favorite episodes, tag me and use the hashtag GoingInBlind. You can also join my mailing list at zachtidwell.net. And if you know someone you think I should talk to, have them send me an email at contact.goinginblind@gmail.com. All right, Jamie, we're rolling. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, I do want to jump right into this here, but before we do that, and just, I guess, so you have a bit of a heads up, I would like to kind of start where it seems like your story starts, which is, or it looked like when you were 8 or 9-ish. But before that, can you tell everyone a little bit of your background? Basically, if you could, you know, little highlights of what you would say that you do, or your resume touch points here, and then we can go from there.
Okay, sure. Yeah. So I'm a social psychologist. I have a specialization in trauma, self-care, and resilience. I've worked in a couple of nonprofit fields in the past. Worked with one that was in children's hospitals, working with severely ill and injured children and their families, and then worked in the domestic violence and sexual assault field for many years. All of those were in like program development, program management, staff management, fundraising, things like that. I'm an author, so I've written a few books on various mental health issues. And other than that, that's kind of where we're at professionally. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm curious on that because I had thought that I knew you had your master's degree, but you said you're a social psychologist. Did you end up getting a doctorate?
No, I haven't gone back for my doctorate work yet.
Well,
so that's in the plans. We'll see when.
I have a friend who is in the trenches with her psychology PhD right now, and it sounds so miserable. So I'm sending
yeah,
you some.
That sounds really encouraging. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. You're welcome for that. I wanted to.
No, I'm a nerd, so studying and learning are my like superpowers, and after many years, and I'm sure we'll get into some of the history of it, and hopefully some people out there can relate, but after many years I finally learned how to apply it in a way that was self-fulfilling and that could help others. And so to me, that's just the best place to be in life.
Well, I guess in reading over, you know, what I know of you, I inferred that you heading down this path probably was at least somewhat inspired by what you went through yourself growing up and as a young adult. Was that the case?
Yep, absolutely. When I first started my bachelor's degree in psychology, I don't remember if it was a professor or another student, but someone made the comment that, you know, all psychologists go into the field to try to figure themselves out, right? I was like, yeah, that's probably true.
I have wondered about that, especially like, okay, when you have that knowledge and your training is to be able to recognize these patterns in others and help them not just identify them, but also know that they have them and maybe correct them in some cases. Like, do you hyper analyze yourself? And I, even in just in your personal relationships, are you able to turn that off?
Do you want an honest answer?
Yes.
Or the professional answer?
Honest.
It's 1,000 times better than it used to be when
my
personal healing has, you know, it's been a journey, which is the case with everyone. And so the more I've grown personally, the more I've been able to manage those things. The educational part has definitely helped. But it's been a piece of the puzzle. I'll say that. It's not, you know, not been the only thing, but it's been a piece of the puzzle. So now it's a lot better. And there are still times where, you know, just like anybody, there's struggles, there's good days, bad days, circumstances. And relationships is definitely one of those issues where if I don't continuously grow and work on myself, I could fall back into, you know, past fears, past reactions. So,
and that's life, though. That's an appropriately mature person is doing that and should be striving to grow constantly.
Yes.
And that's, I think there's, unfortunately, you know, I was fortunate and had, I guess, maybe not in a deliberately communicated way that is what you're supposed to be doing, but in what I was guided to do action wise that is definitely, I was taught that maybe in an indirect way, and I feel like it's served me really well, especially, you know, since I shot myself and adjusting to life after that and losing my sight and everything. But this is not about me, and I want to bring this to you. And again, I was very curious. You know, you lost your mom young, and then it seems like you just got kind of put through the ringer with all of it. Can, if you're cool with it, I guess, what did your mom get sick? Can you, and you were 8, right?
Yeah. So, just one step backwards from that to kind of give perspective on the next part. But my mom and dad divorced when I was like a baby. I don't even think I was a year old. And so I never even saw my dad. There, no pictures, no mention of his name, nothing. It was a very bad separation. And so my mom was like, nah, you're done, you're out. There's no
persona non grata.
Yeah, exactly. So I, you know, never, no pictures, nothing. So it was just she and I, and when I was little, she had been to the doctor a couple of times. But, you know, I knew she went, but had no awareness or understanding of why. And then when I was 8, she got really sick, ended up going in the hospital, and that was it. Later I found out it was from a somewhat rare liver disease. It wasn't sclerosis, but it was something similar. And, you know, this was back in the late 70s. So I don't know if treatment would be different now if the same thing happened, but it was just one of those oddball things. And yeah, so she went in the hospital, was in there about a month, and that was it, passed away.
Jesus. Did you even know your dad was alive?
Nope. I didn't know I had a dad. 100
oh
did
gosh.
Not know I had even had a dad. I remember as a little kid, little, seeing other kids, you know, with their moms and dads, and like, huh, that's weird. Why do they have a dude with them?
Yeah, because I mean, you're only 8. You probably hadn't had the birds and the bees talk yet.
No.
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with a Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Currently, I had my grandparents, so her parents, and they were, you know, the rest of my world at that time. 100% loving, and we actually lived beside them on the same street for a while. So I did have other support there, but yeah, I didn't know my dad until when my mom died. My grandparents tried to get custody of me, and a wise old family court judge said, "Oh, is the boy's father alive?" "Yes." "Okay, well, I'm going to reprimand him to him. I'm going to send him to live with him because he should be with his father." And there was this guy that came and picked me up, and that was the first I knew of it.
That just made my blood boil. Like, the judge doesn't look into that at all. They're like, "Yeah, well, he's alive, so he must be a good fit."
Yeah, exactly. So the whole, you know, just the fact of the trauma of my mom dying at that age, at my age then, and then just being thrown into nothing that I knew, you know, everything changed, you know, family, location, home, school, lost everything, friends, it was all gone overnight. And that was a month before my 9th birthday. And so it was like, you know, kind of like turning 9, and all of a sudden I'm in a different world.
A whole new life, and you're grieving on top of it.
Yes, yes. The grief was severe, was not supported. Ended up, my dad was psychologically and emotionally abusive. There were a couple of times growing up where there was some physical abuse, but it was more harsh punishment, I would say. Too harsh for the circumstances, but the main thing that, you know, that I had to deal with was the psychological and emotional abuse. Like, it was probably within the first few months of going to live with this new family. He had remarried, had another child. So I had a stepmom, I had a stepbrother. And I remember one night, so here I am, maybe 4 or 5 months out from losing my mother. And I remember I started crying because of a memory. And my stepmother went to comfort me. And he literally said, "If you touch him, I'm going to beat you and him both." He needs to suck it up and learn he's got to be a man and not cry. And so that was the tone that continued from there on out.
And you said this was the 70s.
Yes. Yeah.
So do you feel, I mean, obviously that is horrendous. Do you think that was more normal at the time?
Well, yes, to some extent. I think the norm was there in terms of how to raise children, and maybe more so in terms of area. So we're talking about the southeast of the U.S., South Carolina, small country town, farms, factories, that's it. You know, education was not important. And the more I learned later in life, much later in life, you know, my dad was treated pretty much the same way when he was growing up. And he was forced to quit school in the 9th grade to go work in a factory. I mean, so he didn't have it easy either. And so this was kind of that generational thing coming through.
Which obviously doesn't excuse it. I feel like that's...
Yeah, no, definitely not.
A pretty common narrative, though. You see that with abusers or sex offenders a lot, and I'm not making excuses for sex offenders, but where it is like the person is just repeating a cycle that, you know, it's their parents did it to them, their parents' parents did it to their parents, and it just goes back who knows how far. But
yeah.
What for you, I mean, along this, and we can continue through the childhood here, but I'm curious, just for you, what was it that broke that cycle for you to want to and to actually do it?
For me to want to do.
To break that.
I break.
Okay. Yeah. I'm not going to be like my dad. Yeah.
Oh, I remember when I was probably about 12 years old, me talking to one of my best friends, and his dad actually, his dad was pretty rough, but he wasn't, I wouldn't say abusive. He was just rough and gruff. He was the manly type, and he kind of had that, you know, real men are this and real men are that thing, but he was never abusive. He didn't like call his kids names, you know, like stupid and worthless and all that good stuff. But I just remember having a conversation with him, and his dad was mad at him or something, and my friend said, is this how your dad is when he gets mad? I said, this is how my dad is when he's not mad. I said, he's belligerent all the time. I said, if I ever have kids, I will not treat them like this. And so I kind of came to that realization early on that the way I was being treated wasn't right, not just for me, but it just wasn't right in general, you know, to treat a child that way.
Yeah. And so, I mean, this is what came next. Obviously you get transplanted. It's you mentioned you're a nerd, but you were in an area where education wasn't really a priority. Were you a standout in school or what?
Yeah. You know, the movie tropes you see about nerds getting picked on and bullied in school. That was me a lot, you know?
So you were getting it at home and outside of home.
I was, but very, very thankfully, I made a good friend early on. I mean, the first week I was in a new school, you know, a kid came up to me and just started talking. And we're still best friends, you know, now to this day. And that was in fourth grade. So we've been friends since then.
That's
so
neat.
I very luckily had, you know, good friends in school, and the bullying and stuff. I wouldn't say it was severe. It was kind of like movie-ish type, you know, the dumb jock, like, oh, you passed math, I'm going to beat your butt. Oh, yeah. You know, do my homework or else, that kind of thing. Well, and so, it was okay.
That caricature came from somewhere. So
I know, right? Somebody I went to school with became a movie writer. I didn't even know it.
Yeah. Man. So I guess, did you immediately go from high school into, with the intent of going into psychology, or what was the path there?
No. So beyond the grief, I developed depression, and I didn't know it at the time. I didn't know what it was. And so I went through my entire childhood from that point with deep depression, and it was untreated. The very first time that I ever talked to a mental health professional in any way, shape, or form was when I was 18 and I had a suicide attempt. That was the very first time anyone had ever talked to me about depression. And that was literally less than a month after graduating high school. I had no direction, none. When I was a senior in high school, I took the SATs, I took the ASVAB, I took all these tests, you know, and I had the highest SAT score in my school. And so I got a partial scholarship to a pretty large university in the South. And I remember telling my dad that, oh, look, I got this letter and here's what it says. And he's like, I'm not paying for you to go to college. Are you crazy? You need to go out and get a real job, you know. And my graduation present for graduating high school was a speech. And it was, you're about to turn 18. You can either pay rent or get out. And it wasn't, you know, hey, here's the encouraging, helpful way to, you know, help you do whatever you want to do. Go to college, get a job, get a place to live, nothing. It was literally like, get out. I don't care if you live in the, sleep in the gutter, but you're going to get out.
After having obviously all the, everything else that had happened, then I'm assuming he probably wasn't supportive in anything for the remainder of your childhood. So like you never really, they never expressed any pride in you or anything. And now this was kind of the tipping point was.
There was one time in school, and I think this was maybe like fifth or sixth grade or something. I had won a competition, a geography competition, and I actually placed in the top 20 for the state. And the there was this program, and it's kind of like an exchange student type program, but not like for a full semester. It was just a trip to Europe. And so the state, the award for this program was like, they paid a certain amount, but the family had to pay a certain amount. And I brought this letter home to my dad, and I think the amount was $1,000. And that was, you know, that helped with airfare, stay, everything. So this was like a month, whole month's trip. And his response reading the letter was like, you're not worth $1,000. You know, you're
not
going anywhere. Your butt's going to stay right here over the summer and work on the farm. So you can get these silly ideas out of your head, that kind of thing. So, yeah. So by the time, you know, again, untreated depression, you know, that was it. Once a week from my 18th birthday, that was all I could take. I was just done. No, wasn't going to college. Had nowhere to go, nothing. And that was it. I did not want to go on anymore. I didn't want to live with that much pain inside.
Yeah. And it feels inescapable, and you're still, I mean, you're on the cusp of being an adult, but you've had no support ever. And I'm assuming no one to actually teach you how to navigate any of that. Obviously you weren't even allowed to grieve. So did almost losing you wake your dad up at all?
Nope. They said I ended up spending a month in the, you know, mental health hospital, came home, and he was quiet for a while, but then within a few months, kind of started drifting back into the normal territory of, yeah, that was just all a cry for attention. You were just trying to get, you know, everybody's sympathy and blah, blah, blah. So there was still no turn at that time.
Yeah. And I guess I'm curious because, you know, I've thought about this a lot. Mental health is something that I talk about a lot with my own story. And then, you know, just trying to, in hopes that it'll save lives and get people having these conversations like we're having right now. But with you having been through it and then also being in the mental health field, I'm curious, like I've thought about this a lot. I feel, you know, I've got suicide on both sides of my family and murder suicide on one side. Like I feel like I always get asked what the warning signs are, which is, you know, the generic question that people go to. I feel like, especially when they don't know what else to ask, they're like, what are the warning signs?
Right. And right.
I think because, you know, everyone wants to think that we can stop this. And I just, I've always felt like the warning signs that are
taught and talked about all the time aren't really very representative of what's going on. I think it is, I have this feeling in general, you know, my thought is that there's, well, in speaking about suicide attempts, there are people who truly, you know, have reached that point and truly want to die. And there are people who think that they want to die. And I think these cliche overt warning signs that are talked about of, okay, well, you know, Jamie was making all these comments of, oh, well, maybe you'd be better off without me, and making obscure posts on social media, or Jamie was giving all of his things away. I feel like that points more so to the second category of the person who, and they need just as much help as someone who truly wants to die. I think that it presents differently because that person who thinks that they want to die does actually want help. And yes. Whereas, you know, I hid my depression up to the minutes before I shot myself. I had been recording a suicide video. My uh-huh. roommate came home early. I went out and talked to him like nothing was wrong, and then went back in my room and shot myself. And I'm, uh-huh. I know that was a lot to unpack there, but do you have any thoughts on that? And in terms of the things that I just said, agree, disagree, just have you thought about that yourself?
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. And I do agree. And both personally and professionally, if a person is being vocal in whatever form about the issue, about suicidal ideation, or I just don't want to be here anymore, I can't take it anymore, they generally want someone to say, okay, I'm here for you. What do you need? How can I help you? Here, let me give you a hug. Let's get the emotions out and let's talk about it. What can I do to help you?
Yes.
Most of the cases, most, not all, but most, when a person is, they're done, they're going to do it, it is that writing a letter and leaving it on the dresser kind of thing. It is that secretly moving beneficiaries and accounts around. It is the quiet movement, the quiet preparation, if there is any, and it is not generally broadcasted. With mine, I didn't tell a soul. Matter of fact, mine was really, really kind of strange. I was working at a convenience store, third shift, and I hadn't had this job long, but I started it when I was a senior in high school, obviously. And so I was like, I planned it out. I was like, the convenience store, we sell sleeping pills. I'm third shift. Generally, you know, I go in at 9 o'clock at night, and by 11:30-ish, most people have come through and done their business and are gone. And I'm usually by myself for, you know, until like 5 a.m. And so I can go in, I can just work. And once the crowd dies down, get some sleeping pills, take them, and just relax
fade
and just
away.
go to sleep and fade away. Yep. And so I completed part of the plan. I thankfully didn't complete all of it, but I ended up taking 3 boxes of sleeping pills.
So got a good nap in.
36. Yeah. I never went to sleep.
What?
I never even dozed off. Took 36 sleeping pills and just stood there waiting and waiting. And it was after midnight. I don't know the exact time, but I want to say 12:30, 1 o'clock. A local police officer just happened to come in to get a soda or something like that. And he noticed, he was like, I guess my eyes, glassy, slurred speech, something. And he was like, what's wrong with you, dude? And I'm like, I'm good. He's like, no, something's wrong with you. What, are you on something? No, I don't do drugs. No. And he kept pressing and kept pressing. And I finally told him, and he called the ambulance. And so, yeah, it was miraculous in the literal sense. So yeah, to back to your question, the, you know, what are those signs to look for? The signs to look for are just when you know someone is struggling with a mental illness, especially depression, PTSD, in that realm. If you know that they have a history of that, that's your warning sign. You may not get another. So if they lose their job, if their spouse leaves them, if somebody important to them dies, you need to be on it. You need to be on it and just keep checking in on them, you know? Keep checking in on them.
Intentionally. That's yep. Another thing. It's not, you know, we ask, I think I asked you when you entered the in here for the podcast, like, how are you? But like when we ask that, it's not, you know, even if we were friends and I asked you that like that, that's a greeting. That's not, I'm actually asking
right.
you. It's
right, right. Yeah.
It needs to be a, hey, I've noticed a change in your baseline behavior. Also, yeah. You know, or yep. I know you're going through this and exactly. I've noticed the baseline. And if you're exactly. direct and confront someone about it, that change in the baseline specifically, that opens the door for them to open up about it. And if, again, that's still on them to speak up, but that's another thing where like, I don't sure. get why we don't talk about that.
Yeah, well, and part of that goes to the stigma, back to the stigma. Part of it is if you've never been there, you're kind of afraid because you don't know how to handle it. And I get that. If you've got a family member, a close friend, then you know they might have depression or you know they have been through something catastrophic. You just don't know how to handle it. And so you're kind of like, oh, you know, I'm thinking about them or, you know, I think about this issue or whatever, but I don't know what to say. I don't know the right thing to say. And so it can be tough. It can be tough. And you just have to kind of hurdle that fear and say, I'm just going to do it. I'm just going to ask the question that I'm afraid to ask, but it's worth it. And then the stigma part, you know, we're still, mental health issues are still a stigma. It doesn't matter that we've been through, you know, decades now of open discussion. It's still not as surface level as it needs to be, and especially for men. So if it's a man and you're like, hey, how are you doing? I promise you, their first answer is going to be, I'm good, I'm fine.
He's not going
to
tell you
even if
shit.
It's not. Yeah. You got to press. You got to press. No, really. What's going on with you? I know you've had this in the past and I love you, so I'm checking up on you. What's going on? And if you keep pressing, if you have a trustworthy relationship, after a little bit, that person will start to open up. But you have to press, because we're raised, even if you're not in an abusive childhood where you can't share your emotions, we're still, the norm for men is still being raised to silently carry burdens and not show weakness and definitely not be a problem for other people.
Yeah. And it's tough too if you're the person on the other end of that, where someone is asking you that, like, it's speaking out sucks. Like it's uncomfortable. And then then you have to confront whatever it is. And that is, it's uncomfortable and it's hard and it doesn't feel tenable when you start, which is not uncommon for most things, right? Like getting started is always the hardest part, as corny as that sounds. But for you, you said you were they kept you in the mental health facility for a month after that. Did you feel like you got the help that you needed and were ready to face things when you came out of that?
No. Like I said, that was the first introduction I had to any kind of mental health help at all. It was a good introduction. It sounds kind of weird, like I'm speed dating or something, but, I didn't have any support after that, which was what was needed. Because if you do go to a facility like that, you know, release you. If you're not suicidal, they're going to release you. Well, the next step is, here, you need to go see a local doctor. You need to go see a local therapist. So, you know, especially still as a kid, you have to have some kind of support for that. And that just wasn't there. And I wasn't ready either to, or I wasn't ready to do it on my own, I'll say. It was still just very raw, and I still just could not see a light at the end of the tunnel. I was not suicidal by then, but it was just, you know, there was nothing for me to look forward to, nothing, no goals, nothing. Just
hopeless still.
Yeah, it was in like mid-20s before I actually started wanting to do better and wanting to get help. And then, you know, kind of started that journey of healing and going to therapy and seeking out help, which, you know, kind of was in tandem with me starting school and starting college for the first time in my mid-20s, studying psychology.
And I guess I'm just, my mind's kind of blown. I mean, you come out of that after basically having been given the boot, even out of your house. So now you're 18, you've just been released from a psych ward and are now homeless. You don't have, like you said, I mean, there's no prospects. You're in this little town. Like, what, in that time in between, like, what did you do for that year and a half, 2 years between 18 and 20?
I drifted on the open seas like a wandering boat with no captain. Not too long after coming back home, I did end up going to a local factory, getting a job. And after that, I got an apartment and moved out and ended up hanging out with, I hate to say, the wrong crowd, but that it was what it was. And I, you know, I'm not playing all innocent, but I just drifted out and just wandered for a few years, you know, drank pretty much every day, smoked pot every day, got into trouble, you know, had a few run-ins with the criminal justice system. Nothing major, but just, there was nothing. It was a nothingness for probably 3 to 4 years.
Gosh. So that seems, going from that to now I'm going to go to college for psychology. Was it because of those experiences?
They helped direct me. So wallowing in the mud, even during that time, I knew that that was not where I wanted to be. I didn't want to be, you know, at the bar every night until 1 a.m. and just drinking. I didn't want to be out, you know, in dangerous places. So I kind of always had that sense. And then when I hit 24, my first child was born, and that was the turning point.
That's not the first time I've heard that, like becoming a father or a mother. Yeah.
I was like, okay, remember that saying I said I wasn't going to, you know, do this to my kids? I'm not. So let's put the brakes on the BS and let's get to work. Let's do something positive. And so, you know, even in that moment, I thought, okay, well, I'm going to do the right thing and be a dad and be a husband. And, you know, it was the beginnings of the change and the journey. And so, yeah, that's when I decided, okay, I really am interested in psychology. So let's go take that. I didn't know what I wanted to do with it at the time. I just knew I was interested in it. That was, you know, let's do this. I like it. Let's learn more.
Yeah. And I was curious to ask you about this because I had actually, so when I got out of the Marines, I was going to school for nursing. I shot myself while I was going to school for nursing. So once I was blind, like, you can't be a nurse. I tried finding proof of a blind nurse somewhere. I was like, I'm going to do it. There, you can't do it, which makes sense. Kind of a liability. So,
yeah.
But I wound up, my natural, like, next natural step was, okay, I'll go for clinical psychology. And when I think it was, it might have been in my first semester of classes after I went back to school, it was basically I had to take, you know, this welcome to the field of psychology type of entry level class. And they had mentioned very specifically that in, obviously I'm paraphrasing here, but in order to do anything in the field of psychology, you really need, in terms of like directly working in the field, you needed a PhD or a PsyD. And obviously that's not the case. So I would, you know, there's, I think a lot of curious people listen to this show and there might be someone else who's heard that before. And that's, I wanted to pick your brain on that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you don't have to have a PhD by any means to be, and there's kind of levels. I mean, it's just like, you know, bachelor's your first 4 years, then master's, then PhDs. There's levels to it. And each level opens up a different opportunity, but you don't have to have that to get into it and to actually do some good. I think most people that go into psychology, you know, barring the joke about the going into it to figure yourself out, most people go into it because they want to help. They want to make a difference in other people's lives, in society, and individuals. Your bachelor's level, you're looking at social work. You can go in the door. I mean, you can literally walk across the graduation stage, grab your diploma, and walk into the door of a job with a bachelor's degree. I remember being courted when I was a senior. We had a different agencies come in and say, hey, look, we're offering you a job today, you know, before you even graduate, we can have your desk ready, you know, the next day. You can absolutely go into nonprofit work, entry level. And here's a cool thing, I want to share one more story.
And go for it, man. We got all the time in the world.
I'm going to try to give it the short version. Okay. I get excited when I talk about this stuff because I'm so passionate about it. But so when I started my bachelor's degree, I didn't know what I wanted to do. The more I got into it, the more I realized, wow, you know, this applies to me. It applies to others. And I want to help other people. So about my junior year, I was like, okay, I want to go into therapy. I want to be a therapist and I want to work with teenage boys, mostly who are in the system. You know, their parents are in prison, they're in foster care, homeless, already on drugs and alcohol, that kind of thing. Because been there, done that, I can relate. And I can understand a little bit of their story. Well, when I was a senior, I did an internship for about 3 months at a local boys' home. And all it took was 3 months to cancel those plans. I would go home almost every night that I worked there and cry. It was too much. I couldn't do it. I was too empathetic for one. I absorb people's emotions, and talking to one or two people is cool, but after talking to three to five a day and hearing these kids, I'm going to be homeless next week. I'm going back to juvie next week, and not being able to physically do something to help them. I couldn't do it.
Yeah. That's what I was going to ask. Like, is it the lack of, I mean, you can just be there to listen, but you have really no agency in the situation.
Right. It's a different role. And this took some maturity. Obviously not in that moment, but the more I've grown throughout my career, the more I've realized that, and this was kind of the point I was going to come back to in terms of different types of jobs for different levels, is being a therapist is not the only thing to be able to help people. If you're really, really good at social media, you love cropping videos and you love social media posts and keeping up with the trends and stuff, but you want to help, you want to give back, you can go work for a nonprofit and be their social media manager. And guess what? You're helping spread awareness. You're helping spread education. You're helping giving resources to people that are online scrolling, that are desperate, that feel like their life is going nowhere. And they may come across that one video, you know, that says, oh, here's some people that can help me. So there's, you don't have to follow one set path in order to use your skills and your talents to make a difference. So I canceled the idea of going into being a therapist for my next role. And that's kind of when I went into the nonprofit world and into program development, program management, and just flourished, because I could help people, but I could use my skills and my strengths to do it and not be that one-on-one, you know, person.
More of a facilitator kind of role.
Yes. I could go into the community and give speeches and classes about domestic violence, about healthy relationships, about, you know, breaking these, you know, generational curses, so to speak, on parenting and intimate partner relationships. I could do all that, and I could do it with the knowledge and understanding, but not sit across from, you know, like I said, four or five people a day listening to their trauma.
Yeah.
Because that was too much for me.
But you are the perfect person to be doing all of that. Like everything that you went on to do, or what, in any of those capacities, really, like, you've been through it.
Yeah.
That is the best person to be doing that and helping educate others on it. And I mean, you can tell when someone's talking about something and they're not speaking from experience, right? Like that shows. We can see right through that with people.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have really any, it takes the wind out of the sails on things when someone's just kind of reiterating secondhand knowledge.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
That's awesome. And you said that was all in the nonprofit space.
Yep. And, so I worked there for, you know, for many years, and then always had the goal in mind, or the dream in mind, that I eventually wanted to go back and get my master's. And interestingly enough, when I was working at the domestic violence agency, I kept noticing that we were working off of old information. I would see stuff come in terms of materials, you know, educational materials, outreach materials, things like that, that I was like, this is old. We're past a lot of this. I mean, you know, this stuff is like 10, 20 years old. We know better. And that was kind of where it sparked in my mind. I was like, I know what I'm going to do. When I get the chance to go back and get my master's, I'm going to make sure that I get the most current information, and then I'm going to try to figure out a way how to get that out to people, whether it be individually, whether it be publicly, whatever, you know, that's my goal. And years later, the opportunity came up. It was the perfect storm. You know, my youngest child. My son was finishing college, so he was already got his, already out, got a house on his own, rented a house. He was kind of free, so to speak, and it was just me, and I was in a great position working from home. And so I was like, yep, I can do it. I can take classes from home. I can do it remotely. I researched, found a school that had a program I want specializing in trauma, and off I went, off to the races.
And how much, because I know, yeah, I've been a fly on the wall. She just, my friend that I mentioned earlier just finished her first year of that program. So like I've gotten to kind of see or, you know, hear what a lot of that your first year of pursuing a PhD entails. And I mean, it's so much research and working like on projects that will be published in, mm-hmm. you know, into different scholarly journals. Is that mm-hmm. the same when you were going for your master's? Is there that same leaning into actually getting published as a researcher?
Yes and no. So you have that opportunity at the end when you write your thesis paper. You're not really starting off or being pushed. And I say pushed, I don't necessarily mean it like harshly, but the goal is not, okay, you've got to write this paper to get it published. It's just, especially with the remote classes, it was all research and writing. So there is no going okay. sitting in class taking notes. It's research and writing. I mean, I've got 2 years worth of research and writing that, you know, I've started to use and starting to implement. So yeah, it's, you have the opportunity, but it's not quite the same goal.
Yeah.
As the PhD.
Okay. Yeah. I've always been, it's just, it's fascinating. And I don't even know, I guess it was probably, you know, mid-20s when I as silly as that sounds, when I realized or like first was made aware of the fact that like there is that is the other side of you having that level of accreditation is you are also contributing to the field as a whole outside of just your normal work. But it's so, it's interesting. For you, I guess in going and you specialized in trauma specifically with your master's, did that open up other doors for you? And did that allow you to move into a new field as well? Or what, like you were working in nonprofits, so what changed?
Yeah, so, well, the last job in nonprofits was affected by COVID, because I had the grants that basically that paid for my position were all very public facing. You know, I was doing public educations, I was doing public fundraisers, and when COVID hit, that came to a screeching halt within a few months. And so I, you know, made a transition to another field, or just, how I say, a regular job, but being an account manager for a large corporation. And of course, that's what actually ended up leading to me being able to have the opportunity and to be able to afford to go back to get my master's degree. But with that, now, since accomplishing that, it's definitely helped, because one, you know, I have more accreditation, so I have that behind me, but I can also use that kind of to open doors. And once I get in that open door, then it's like, oh, wait a minute. Oh, I have personal experience and I have a lot of practical experience. I've worked, you know, with people going through this and going through that. I've worked in the systems that deal with those socially. And that's something for me that was just very important, was understanding the individual, or the individuals. I don't know how to put it, but what a individual person goes through with mental illness and understanding how that impacts their family, how that impacts their community, how that impacts even the country, and how at the same time, the systems we have in place are impacting those either negatively or positively. And so that's kind of my goal, you know, that I'm working on and working to move towards is finding ways to better the systems that will help people in those areas.
Is that what your book in this series of, you know, ultimate series of books will be?
So the series that I started, and so the first four are out, and I have a few more, you know, that I'm working on in the series are for individuals and their family members. And they are, you know, looking specifically at mental illness issues like anxiety. There's one for depression, clinical depression, PTSD, ADHD. And they are meant to provide people with a way to have, one, a better understanding of what they're dealing with in ways that they can understand. So I try to take, you know, this, the clinical scientific stuff and give it enough understanding to where it's not, you know, gobbledygook. It's not data. It's, look, here's why these chemicals work in your body, and here's what these hormones do. And then the other three-fourths is extremely practical strategies for managing symptoms and building long-term healing.
And I'm guessing those are evidence-based given your background.
Yep. Okay. Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. And so now I am working on a book that I started last year. It's still going to be a while before it comes out. And it's going to be more on the systemic side of, here's a social issue and let's dive deep into it. And it's going to be really, really deep. I mean, it's going to touch some nerves. I'm hoping will help draw attention in the right way to a social issue that can help other people in the field, you know, be encouraged and be equipped to make some positive changes.
And when you say systemic, are you talking, you know, top to bottom from mental health care to the individual? Are you talking about mental health care specifically, the stigma associated with it?
It is a mental health issue among a specific demographic, in this case, a certain career demographic.
Okay.
So I don't want to spoil too much.
I figured the way you were wording that.
It would, for one, it would take us down a big rabbit hole, which would be another like 10-hour discussion.
Okay.
And two, I genuinely want, I know that it's going to touch some nerves, because it affects, it's not just, you know, oh, here's this high level scientific discussion. You know, this impacts people's lives. This impacts families. So I want to be very careful to, as I approach it, you know, to make sure it's not attacking, that it's helping, because I know it's going to expose, a system, and it's not talked about enough. It's not barely talked about, to be honest.
I'll have to have you back on after you get canceled.
Yeah, that'd be great. I would love that.
Yeah. So with the first four books, it was, you mentioned the individuals. So are these case studies of people, like the individuals that you're talking about?
No. It's just
the individual.
For the person that buys and reads this is for them, for the individual themselves. Okay. So like the one on depression, it's on clinical depression. So if you have clinical depression, this is the perfect book for you. Pick it up, read it, and it will help you understand what you're dealing with. It'll help you understand why you have some of the thoughts and feelings and behaviors that you do. It'll help you understand that you're not alone and that this is not your whole person. This is something that is a part of your life. It's a part of what you're dealing with, but it's not all of you. And there's a whole rest of you in there that can come out. And like myself, you can get on a journey of growth and healing, and you will find a world that you never thought was possible, and that probably many other people would never think that you'll ever amount to, ever get to. And it's, again, it's not just encouraging fluff. You know, I know when you're in the middle of the pain, when you're tapped out and you've just been struggling with this for maybe years, you know, all the motivational stuff sounds good, but it's not enough to pull you up. And these books are, like I said, extremely practical, where you can take one step at a time and just follow it and make that one step forward.
Did you address diet and fitness in there at all? I feel like a lot of times people just fucking ignore that that's a thing because we want to hand out SSRIs, and it's like, you're missing an entire this.
Absolutely,
it's so frustrating for me. Yeah,
physical health is mental health. Physical health is mental health. Period. We have enough 1000% proven research and practical application that, for instance, we know this is the whole reason trauma study is important, because when you're a child and your brain and your nervous system is developing, when you experience trauma, it physically alters the neuro pathways in your brain, and it physically alters the amount of hormones your nervous system produces. So no, of course you're going to grow up and have some anxiety, or maybe depression, or maybe PTSD. It's not separate. It's not just in your mind. It's not just dealing with a memory or a thought pattern. It's physical. Your diet, your gut microbiome, your gut produces serotonin. Many people don't know this. You even if you've heard of serotonin, you think, oh yeah, it's produced in the brain. It has to do with feeling good, feeling happy. Yeah, but your gut produces it. So if you have an unhealthy gut, yeah, guess what? You're going to have a dysregulation of chemicals in your brain that are literally turning the off and on switch of when you can be happy or not.
Yeah, and I can't remember who it was. I'll have to Google and try and figure out who this was that said this. So next time that this conversation comes up, I can actually give them credit for what they said. But essentially, they were pointing out the absurdity. So for people who don't realize, like SSRI, those are your depression meds. And they are, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And so it's
very good. You get a gold star for today.
Well, I've been on a couple of them. I'm not anymore. But it's the idea there is that he was pointing out, it's absurd that, okay, we know these people have a shortage of serotonin. So we give them meds to ration the insufficient amount that they have instead of trying to promote creating more of it. And it's just, so it's, that's, if you had said that you are like, if I had asked about the diet and exercise thing and you didn't have any words to say about it, you're like, oh, you don't need that, I would have internally judged you so hard. So
I know, right?
I'm so glad. Like,
oh, wait, this show just suddenly got canceled. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was loving this conversation.
Yeah. Each of the four books so far, all of them in this series are you know, have an extensive chapter on, you know, diet and exercise. And I don't just put a sentence in there that says, yeah, you should go exercise. I go step by step. I help people understand why it's important. Again, trying to keep it, you know, keep the discussion
approachable,
down to approachable. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. But I also make it, you know, relatable. I make it doable. So for instance, one tip that I give, and this one's from personal experience, when I was being very intentional about my exercise, very intentional about even just the minimum, and still having depression, you know, I would say, okay, at lunch, on my lunch break at work, I'm going to walk for 15 minutes in one direction. Because guess what happens at the end? I have to turn around and come back, unless I'm just going to play hooky from work, unless I'm just going to escape. But if I've walked in one direction for 15 minutes, I got to turn around and come back. That's my 30-minute walk. That's all. That's it. That's all you need. If you're doing that consistently, that's a 10 to 20% improvement in your physical health, which will be a 10 to 20% improvement in your mental health. It doesn't take bodybuilding. It doesn't take, you know, all these things to make those little improvements. And so, yeah, I really, really go through and try to help people find what they will enjoy, find what's going to be beneficial, and just start. Just take the first one. Just take that first step and start from there. And then you can go on. Then you can say, yeah, you know what? I love swimming. I'm going to go do that. I love this. I love that. Try different things. You never know. I started kayaking. I never knew that I would love kayaking. And man,
doing white water or flat water?
Flat water. Okay. I've done both, but just on a regular basis, flat water. Man, to just get out there first thing in the morning on the weekends before all the boaters get there, it's the most peaceful thing you've ever had in your life. Just to be sitting out there in the water. Wow, this is amazing. It's therapeutic. Yeah. Who knew?
I think that's a great point of you just have to start somewhere. And that's the case, you know, even if it's someone who's morbidly obese and just needs to get right back on the right track, or for mental health. And I think where you, with that, the end goal should be working to where that is a non-negotiable part of your day. Yeah. You know, that is something I take my health very seriously, and, you know, I eat right and I exercise every day. I lift weights 6 days a week and I go to jiu-jitsu 4 or 5 days a week as well. And
cool.
It doesn't matter how shitty I'm feeling mentally. Like, you know, I still deal, as a result of brain injuries, still deal with depression and at times. And that is one thing that does not budge. That happens. Yeah. And I might still feel like shit after, but it is still, there's a noticeable improvement, even if I'm still depressed, in that the baseline of the day. Mm-hmm.
It is such an important piece of the puzzle. And the more you do, the more you grow and heal, the more you will feel the results, and the more you will appreciate the results from it. Aside from, and again, we're so used to, oh, if you're doing physical activity, if you're hitting the gym, if you're doing this and that, it's to get in physical shape. Well, of course, if you're doing it regularly, yeah, you're going to get in better shape. That's great. But it is such an important piece of mental health that is just overlooked. And I do know why, but that's neither here nor there. Why every doctor and every therapist, that should be a checkbox on your treatment plan automatically. It not just, okay, yeah, here's the pill, here's the SSRIs, The medicine is amazing. It is needed. It is a piece of the puzzle. But you really, and this is something, again, I have just learned over the years. I've learned through hardship. I've learned through success and failure that you have to be a student of yourself. You have to learn to be your own leader if you want to get where you're going.
Hold yourself accountable.
But the good news is that it works. It works, and you can do it. You can get to a point to where, you know what? I still have these struggles, and I still have ups and downs, and I still this and that. But man, it's 1,000 times better than it used to be.
Yeah. And that's perspective, man. Perspective goes a long way. It really does. And I think this is a beautiful place to start wrapping things up. I think we've left people with a lot to think about and probably even do some research on. Where have I missed anything? I want you to be able to plug everything. And obviously I'll have all your links in the show notes as well. But have I missed anything else here that you would like to talk about?
No, I don't think so. I think just, you know, to encourage people that, yeah, it's scary and you don't know where you're going to end up, but just take that one step and just, if it's the one thing that you can do, just work on that. Just start there and go. You won't regret it. Learn all that you can. Don't rely on what you've seen on TV. Don't rely on what your family's told you. Don't rely on what the doctor tells you.
Well, we just told you.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying dismiss the tools that are offered. Take the tools that are offered, but they're not the whole toolbox. Not by a long shot. So learn all that you can.
That's awesome. And where can everyone find everything that you're doing and your books as they come out and to get news on whenever this big one drops?
Sure. So the website is managingmentalhealth.net, and there has the links for each of the books that are already out. So you can go there. Plus it's got, you know, the usual, my social media and email and stuff like that. If you want to reach out personally or professionally. So yeah, and that's a good place. And obviously I will, once the next one comes out, that'll be released on there too. And on social media.
Awesome. Are you doing audiobooks for these things?
I've thought about that, and I think I will eventually. I don't know. I don't have that on like a calendar, so to speak, but eventually I will get to that step. Yes.
Awesome, man. Well, seriously, thank you for all this. I know we talked about some heavy, heavy stuff, and thanks for letting me pick your brain on the whole education process and in the field. And just, I think what you're doing is powerful, and you seem like a very kind, genuine man. And it just, I really enjoyed this conversation. So thank you.
Yeah. I appreciate it. It's always a great opportunity, you know, to just share something that somebody might resonate with, and, you know, whether it's personally, professionally, just encourage people to, the more we can talk about these issues, the more we can be vulnerable. Hopefully we can lower some of the stigmas and, you know, give us all a chance to grow.
Yeah, and kind of pave a path for others to follow in the footsteps of and have some guardrails in doing it, hopefully. So
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it, Zach.
And thanks everyone at home for listening to another episode of Going In Blind. Please rate and review the show wherever you listen, and then share this around with a curious mind who needs to hear it.